who was the man on the other end of the line talking to President Trump. Ukraine's president is a comic-turned-politician-turned-potential smoking gun.
It's so funny that the former comedian turned president, he got in the situation where he became the reason for the impeachment inquiry into the president of the United States.
Funny, ironic, not funny, haha. It's no laughing matter in Ukraine. Also, a new report from the UN paints a grim picture of warming oceans and people living along the coasts. The leader of one island nation has seen the worst, and he says there's no plan B. And in France, dollhouses and play kitchens, not just for girls.
Starting from today, the toys industry in France will be less sexist, we will say.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to be back with you. We start today with nine little words. I would like you to do us a favor. Could those words get President Trump impeached? It's what Trump said to Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky, do us a favor. That's according to a declassified White House document of a July phone call between the two men. The favor? Investigate former Vice President Joe Biden and what his son Hunter were doing in Ukraine. Trump held two news conferences today. Earlier, he spoke alongside Ukraine's President Vladimir Zelensky and addressed that phone call. The World's Matthew Bell has been following the story. And then Trump spoke again later this afternoon, flanked by Secretary of State Pompeo and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. How has he been defending himself with the news of this phone call out there and the impeachment inquiry?
Right. It was a lot of deflection. I have to say, even by Trumpian standards, this was a confusing, rambling, lengthy news conference in which Trump, he talked a lot about his accomplishments at the UN General Assembly this week and then sort of went into vague conspiracy theories. He talked about, basically he said the Democrats are just jealous of his electoral victory in 2016. This is all about politics. He said this is about the quote-unquote Russian witch hunt. Here's a little bit of what the president had to say today.
And the witch hunt continues, but they're getting hit hard on this witch hunt. Because when they look at the information, it's a joke. Impeachment for that? When you have a wonderful meeting or you have a wonderful phone conversation?
So that was President Trump this afternoon at the UN. And earlier, as I said, the president joined the Ukrainian president, Zelensky, a joint news conference between the two of them. How did that all go?
And this was wild because we had this morning was the memo, as you mentioned, that came from the White House about this phone call. And the Democrats say, look, you know, read it yourself. And what comes across to them, they're saying, is a quid pro quo that the president was pressuring the Ukrainian president using U.S. military aid, congressionally approved, to get the Ukrainian government to dig up dirt on Joe Biden. So that appearance was interesting. One of the first questions when reporters had a chance to ask went to Zelensky, and it was, did he feel pressured by Donald Trump? Here's some of what he had to say.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be involved to democratic, open, elections of USA. No, you heard that we had, I think, good phone call. It was normal. We spoke about many things, and so I think, and you read it, that nobody pushed me. Yes.
In other words, no pressure.
So, Matthew, what next with this unfolding political drama?
I think, you know, today was a long day in the news business, but the truth is an impeachment inquiry is a long marathon. This thing is just beginning now. Tomorrow we're going to hear from the Director of National Intelligence. We're presumably going to hear more about this whistleblower case. This thing is just beginning.
The World's Matthew Bell, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Now to New York, where world leaders are gathered at the annual UN General Assembly. A lot of important matters being debated and discussed: climate change, de-escalating wars, and potential wars. Work is getting done, but you can't blame people for also dishing about what's going on in Washington. The World's Shirin Jafari is in New York at the UN and joins us. So how's the news of the impeachment inquiry playing out in the halls of the UN today, Shirin?
Hey, Marco. So the news about the impeachment inquiry has really overshadowed everything that's happening today at the UN. The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky spoke this morning, and we were all paying attention to what he has to say. And we were also paying attention to his body language because, you know, Marco, all of a sudden, Zelensky is finding himself at the center of a serious political tension in the U.S.
So what did he say about Trump in this inquiry?
He didn't mention Trump or his phone call with him. Instead, he focused on what he called the threats from Russia and Russian aggression in the region. He urged other countries to help Ukraine and, through an interpreter, warned that ultimately Ukraine's war affects the entire world.
In the modern world where we live, there is no more somebody else's war, and none of you will feel safe until Russia is waging war against Ukraine in the center of Europe. And a thought that all of this has nothing to do with you or will never touch your interests could be fatal.
So the main attraction today at the UN was supposed to be Iranian President Hassan Rouhani. I guess he ended up playing second fiddle to the Zelensky show. Did Rouhani say anything interesting?
So given the recent tensions in the region, the attack, for example, on the oil fields in Saudi Arabia back on September 14th, you would think that Iran would be the headline today at the UN General Assembly. Rouhani spoke for about 20 minutes and said through an interpreter that Iran is ready to respond to any sort of aggression to its territory.
We shall not tolerate the provocative intervention of foreigners. We shall respond decisively and strongly to any sort of transgression to and violation of our security and territorial integrity.
You know, I know this annual UN General Assembly meeting is full of hallway chatter about global issues. Is the news about President Trump and Zelensky affecting those conversations as well?
I spent a little bit of time this morning in the hallways at the UN, and I also attended a few of the press conferences. And everybody I talked to said that they are pretty much focused on getting what they're, you know, here to do. And everybody is staying on message. I mean, look, you know, delegations from all different countries only have a short amount of time to talk to each other, to sit down with each other and resolve some of the issues that they are here to resolve. So they really want to get the best out of this time that they have. It's only 5 days.
Focused on their business, as is the world, Shirin Jafari at the UN General Assembly in New York. Shirin, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
There's another world leader in hot water, Boris Johnson. The British Prime Minister flew back from New York to London just in time for Parliament to reconvene. Johnson left the UN General Assembly early after Britain's High Court said his move to suspend Parliament was unlawful. It's all about Brexit and the looming deadline for the UK to leave the European Union at the end of next month. Things got heated today in Parliament.
Since I am asked, let me tell them the truth. They could vote no confidence at any time, but they're too cowardly.
So what's it like for people in the UK living through the back and forth over Brexit for more than 3 years now? Stressful. Here's the world's Orla Barry in London.
As the shock, and for some, joy, of the referendum results sank in that morning in June 2016.
The people of Britain have voted to leave the European Union in an historic move that has stunned the rest of the continent.
Few would have predicted that over 3 years later, Britain would still be in limbo. For many, the daily twists and turns of the Brexit negotiations have become too exhausting to follow, as one woman told a BBC call-in show this week.
I just don't know anymore. I've just lost the will to live. I can't be bothered with a lot of it anymore.
For others, every vote and every court ruling just adds anxiety on top of anxiety.
They have difficulty sleeping, eating, you name it.
Emmy von Derzen is a psychotherapist.
Every bit of news is resonant of difficulties, fear, anxiety, an uncertain future, and a sense that their lives don't matter to people anymore.
Van Derzen is a Dutch national who's lived in the UK for 40 years. She set up a free counselling service 2 years ago for other EU citizens living in Britain who are worried about Brexit. and she's felt the impact personally.
Despite the fact I have British children and set up businesses and had been here for 40 years, I was refused UK citizenship when I applied for it in 2016, and it took me an entire year and two refusals before I was able to obtain that.
As the latest Brexit deadline of October 31st approaches, Von Dersen says her clients are becoming increasingly distressed.
It's so close now, and there are so many people who are in a situation where they can't see their future anymore. We have clients saying, I will kill myself at the end of October if we're going through with this, that I have nowhere else to go back to. My life will just be broken. I'm being told I can't stay in this country. There's just no way to live.
And it's not just EU citizens or even those who voted Remain who are feeling overwhelmed. A survey by the Mental Health Foundation, an NGO, found 4 in 10 adults in the UK are feeling powerless and angry over Brexit. And while Remainers expressed more fear, a third of leavers say the whole experience is having a negative impact on their mental well-being too. That includes politicians.
Do you know, I've lost a lot of weight. I mean, I've gone from a sort of over a 34 to almost under a 30 now.
This is Conservative MP Hugh Merriman.
You know, today I'm getting a heck of a lot of abuse because of the way I voted. You know, I'm betraying Brexit. I'm the Chancellor's tea lady. I mean, look, I've started seeing a counsellor myself this year because actually I've just realised I need to get sort of proper control in my life. So, I mean, that's a good thing.
Emmy van Dersen, the therapist, says her free counselling service is only for EU citizens in the UK. If they accepted British nationals, she says, they'd be flooded with clients. She hopes that people won't need her service much longer. But in the meantime, she has some advice for those feeling overwhelmed by Brexit anxiety.
Join in with other people. The worst thing to do is to blame it on yourself or to stay in isolation. The most important thing to do is to speak up about it and to find like-minded people for support.
For The World, Orla Barry, London.
Going to space is challenging enough. Now imagine all the instructions about how to get there are completely indecipherable.
The Soyuz, the spacecraft will take us to space, is all in Russian. The first time I sit in the Soyuz, it's all in Russian. For me, it's like alien letters there. Oh, how come I will learn all of this?
That's just one of the particular challenges faced by Haza Mansouri. Today, Mansouri becomes the first astronaut from the United Arab Emirates to blast into space. And don't worry, he did learn enough Russian to man the spacecraft that will take him to the International Space Station. Once there, he'll be the first Arab to ever step foot in it.
For me, I think the overwhelming feeling is thrilled. I am proud to be representing my country in this mission.
The Emirati space program is small, like really small. There's Mansouri, and then there's his backup for this trip, Sultan Al Nayadi. But despite its size, Dubai's space program has big goals. They want to reach Mars by 2021 and build a settlement there 100 years from now. But that's all in the future. Nayadi says for now, both he and his colleague are feeling ready to go, despite the uncertainty of space travel and, you know, not being fluent in Russian.
Well, space is tough. Space is unpredictable. Anything is possible. So you have to trust in your knowledge, the training that you receive. You have to trust in your equipment, your spacecraft.
Mansouri will be up in the ISS for 8 days, but he won't be that far from home.
Something to mention is about the food in space. Since we have our Arabic food, actually, we will be eating that in space. Balalit, madruba, and saluna.
Mansouri may go down in history today, but he's not forgetting where he wants to end up eventually.
This is only the beginning. In future, planning to go to moon and beyond.
From the Emirates to the moon and beyond. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Oceans are like sponges. They absorb extra heat and help regulate the temperature of the planet. A report released by the UN today warns, though, the system is breaking. Co Barrett is one of the authors of the study.
The world's ocean and cryosphere have been taking the heat for climate change for decades, but it can't keep up. The consequences for nature and humanity are sweeping and severe.
Climate change is threatening marine ecosystems and our ability to harvest seafood. Glaciers and ice sheets are melting. Hundreds of millions of people living along coasts around the globe are at risk of flooding. The world's Carolyn Beeler is at the UN General Assembly in New York this week. Hey, Carolyn.
Hey, Marco, I'm overlooking the East River right now to illustrate a main point from the authors of this report, which is that even though the changes to oceans and glaciers are happening in faraway places, they're having impacts all around the world in places like New York and the bodies of water that surround it.
This is one of those massive reports that talks about everything from ocean acidification to how we humans are changing the tides. What stood out to you?
The sea level rise projections. In this report, sea level rise for 2100, if emissions continue on unabated, is projected to reach as high as 1.1 meters, which is 3 feet and 4 inches or something like that, which is a little bit higher than the last report from this same body, which was released just back in 2014. So there's been a not insignificant increase in that projection in just a few short years. And the reason is largely because of West Antarctica. Here's one of the report's authors. There's Robert Hallberg.
This is based on new studies of the ice sheets around Antarctica and the observations that those ice sheets, especially on the Western Hemisphere side, are losing mass more quickly than previously they had been observed to do.
Marco, I've been to West Antarctica. I've seen those ice sheets they're talking about. And we've talked a lot here on the show about how the biggest question mark when it comes to how much sea level will rise going forward is what happens there. So this report found that there is enough new evidence of melting in Antarctica to boost this very consensus-driven and some call conservative estimate about sea level rise.
So 4 inches when we're talking 3 feet in, you know, relative terms, it doesn't sound like much. How significant is that change?
It is more significant than that 4 inches makes it seem. It's a sign that the more we learn about ice sheet melting in Antarctica, the higher and higher our sea level rise estimates go up. And when you're talking about sea level rise as a whole, we're talking about some 1 billion coastal residents who will be at risk by 2100, according to this report. Here's Robert Hallberg again. He works for NOAA, and he's talking about the impact that these ice sheets can have on the spot where I am right now, New York.
A once-in-a-100-year storm, something like Hurricane Sandy that devastated the New York region a few years ago, is something that will become increasingly likely, so that by mid-century, those same sea levels will be encountered not once in 100 years, but on average, every year.
So, Carolyn, what else did this report say that you think we should pay attention to?
One other interesting finding was it mentioned that marine heat waves have doubled since the 1980s, which places more stress on coral, kelp, that other marine life feeds on. And of course, in what's become really familiar language out of reports like this by now, it stressed the need for urgent action and said that the worst impacts to oceans and the cryosphere can be avoided if we drastically cut greenhouse gas emissions fast. Here's Hui-Sung Lee, who's the chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
We are in the race between two factors. One is the human ecosystem's capacity to adapt, and the other one is the speed of impact of climate change. This report indicates that we may be losing in this race.
Yeah, so work faster. Carolyn, you interviewed someone at the UN who is intimately familiar with that race.
That's right. I had the chance to sit down with the Prime Minister of Antigua and Barbuda, Gaston Brown. Of course, Antigua and Barbuda is a tiny Caribbean island nation that was devastated by Hurricane Irma 2 years ago. I talked to him about that and the recovery and also asked him what the increased sea level rise projections released in this report would mean for his country.
We are literally placing our civilization at risk. It means that countries in the Caribbean, parts of these countries will be washed away. And that is why we have to be very vocal about the issue of climate change.
On Monday, at the UN Climate Action Summit, many small island nations, including your own, pledged to increase the ambition of their carbon-cutting promises under the Paris Agreement. But large emitters were largely silent. What message would you have for those large emitters?
They have to understand that we do not have a planet B. To my knowledge, the only viable planet up to this point is planet Earth. The last thing we'd want is an obliteration of the Caribbean civilization as a result of sea level rise and as a result of the general consequences of climate change. So they must take this issue seriously and to understand that what is required is action. In fact, one of my disappointments was that President Trump did not address the issue of climate change. Clearly, it is not a priority issue for the United States, and I think it's extremely unfortunate, considering that, you know, it's the largest economy in the world, and as a consequence, the United States should be taking greater responsibility.
2 years ago, Hurricane Irma devastated the island of Barbuda. I'm wondering if you can describe what the island looked like right after that hurricane and what it looks like now.
Well, it was absolutely horrendous. You know, there was just an atmosphere of hopelessness at the time. The assessment would have indicated that it would have taken at least $220 million to recover Barbuda. Unfortunately, only about, I'd say, $20 million was allocated. And of that, so far, we have only been able to avail ourselves of about $10 million. So with our fiscal challenges, clearly it's a very daunting task. However, we have made significant progress. So far, we have recovered about 50% of the properties that were destroyed.
The entire island of Barbuda had to evacuate after Hurricane Irma. How many residents have returned?
I'd say about 60%. There are about 1,100 people in Barbuda now. There were about 2,000 prior. There are a number of them who are still displaced on Antigua. So we have internally displaced persons, and that is because their homes have not been rebuilt. They're in essence homeless, and we are making every effort to restore their homes as soon as possible in order to resettle them on Barbuda.
You said at the time after that devastation that large developed nations who bear the brunt of responsibility for the crisis of climate change because they've emitted the most greenhouse gases should pay for the recovery in Barbuda. Why do you think the responsibility lays with them?
Well, it's proven that the frequent and ferocious storms that we're experiencing are a consequence of climate change. And we all know that the industrialized countries, they're the ones who are benefiting from these fossil fuels. They make all the profits, while in the Caribbean, we're suffering the consequences. So there is a form of injustice there that has to be corrected. Now, one of the problems that we have in the Caribbean is that the islands are generally small, very limited resources. So whereas international community, they're calling upon us to build a more resilient infrastructure, the reality is we don't have the money. If we are going to proceed in an equitable way, there's a need for greater global cooperation and for the industrialized countries to take responsibility for their actions.
Prime Minister Gaston Brown of Antigua and Barbuda, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you. A pleasure.
A president gets on the line. He calls up his Secretary of Defense or perhaps a world leader.
There are very few people in the room taking notes, and then there are a couple of people out of the room listening.
How calls coming out of the Oval Office get monitored. We've got that phone call coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. The telephone, a vital tool of diplomacy. A call from the Oval Office can be used for all sorts of purposes. Reagan apologized.
We regret very much the embarrassment that's been caused you.
Nixon fumed.
Well, it's a tough thing, Bob. God damn it. I'm never going to discuss this son of a Watergate thing again.
And Clinton congratulated.
Tell you what, this is a lot bigger deal at home than me getting elected president.
And President Trump, as we learned today, asked for a favor from Ukraine's president, that is. To find out more about the protocols for Oval Office phone calls, we reached out to Evelyn Farkas. She was a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense under President Obama.
There are very few people in the room taking notes, and then there are a couple of people out of the room listening, and then they also help with the notes. My understanding from my colleagues is that under the Obama administration, these phone calls were written down verbatim, and that they also believe going into the first year of the Trump administration, based on contacts they had with professionals in the White House who stayed, that the Trump administration also was at least until a year in, if not longer, doing verbatim transcripts, which means it's not transcribed from an audio. It means that they are verbatim notes. Having said that, we know that this White House has played around with the language and put language on their website, for example, that was inaccurate and later had to take it down.
So in the White House's declassified document, they caution that this is not a transcript, but rather a memorandum of a telephone conversation, but it is not verbatim. Is that what you're referring to here?
Yeah, that's what I'm referring to, because normally in colloquial, you know, language, we would expect that a transcript is somebody typing down the words that they hear on an audio tape of a conversation. That's not what this is, although it's called a transcript inside the U.S. government, because they do attempt to write verbatim what each side says. And the reason for that, of course, is that so that the rest of the government and the White House can keep tabs on what was actually said in the conversation so that no one can later assert that something else was said.
Is there an expectation at the White House that the call is being recorded on the other end?
That is expected, yes. Or if it's not expected, we know that people are taking notes on the other end, just as we are taking notes. Again, nobody wants someone to later assert that their president said something they didn't say, or to misconstrue, you know, twist a couple words around, and then all of a sudden you have an international incident. So everyone does try to really make sure on both sides that they have accurate notes.
So compare, if you would, this transcript or this memorandum, if you would, to other transcripts or memos of phone calls that you've seen. Like what we see spoken between Trump and Zelensky here, does it sound surprising? And what struck you?
So the content is surprising. I will also note there were a couple of ellipses, and people have asked me about that, and I don't recall the use of ellipses in previous administrations, but I can't say for sure that it wasn't used. Normally, if you don't understand something, they'll put unintelligible in parentheses. So there is the potential that the ellipses means that something was left out. I just don't know the answer to that. What is shocking is the content. I mean, this should have been a conversation between two presidents to talk about how the United States could better help this new Ukrainian president in defending his territory against the ongoing aggression from Russia, the hot war in Donbass in particular, and then also helping him in his fight against corruption, which was really the mandate that he used to get into power. So that's what the conversation should have been about. And unfortunately, it ended up being about basically how the Ukrainian government could help President Trump get dirt and help him with his own political agenda.
So now that it's out, I mean, this could come back to be a liability in many different ways for Zelensky. Do you think other heads of state in the future are going to be very careful about what they say to President Trump?
Well, it's unusual that this was released, and normally it wouldn't be released because, of course, the other head of state knows what happened in the phone call. And yes, it's probably likely that the Russian government also knew because of all their spying and, you know, their ability to find these things out, especially vis-a-vis Ukraine, where they have special interest and probably also special spies. But the rest of the world can see, and President Zelensky, for whatever reason, did feel compelled to make some negative comments about the European Union and some European leaders, which probably
Angela
doesn't
Merkel
help
and,
him.
Macron specifically.
Yes, exactly. And that doesn't help him, obviously, vis-a-vis those leaders. Now, those leaders understand full well how, unfortunately, our president operates, which is to say that he often requires someone to make a favorable comparison of him to his peers, whoever they may be, and in this case, they're other heads of state. So they are likely to be forgiving. But on the other hand, it is an unfortunate thing for Zelensky to have to bear right now, when he's about to sit down to negotiations with Russia, and those countries are supposed to be sitting there as his steadfast right and left hand at those talks.
Do you expect to ultimately hear audio of this conversation?
Oh, no. My understanding is that the White House doesn't record these conversations, these phone calls. Of course, if a foreign intelligence agency picked it up, I doubt that they would share it willingly with anyone.
Evelyn Farkas was Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense during the Obama presidency. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks, Marco.
So what's the reaction to all of this in Ukraine? Tatiana Kirilluk is with BBC Monitoring in Ukraine's capital, Kyiv.
People went to social media to comment on that, and they're saying that it's so funny that the former comedian turned president. He got in the situation where he became the reason for the impeachment inquiry into the president of the United States. And now people are saying that Ukraine is going to make history if this is actually going to happen, but this is not a good thing from the reputational point of view for us.
How unusual is it for Ukraine to get thrust onto the world stage through an episode like this?
Well, actually, this is not the first time that Ukraine got embroiled in the international scandal, especially related to the U.S. There has been a situation with Paul Manafort before. And now, as Ukrainian experts and commentators are saying, that they have this fear that Ukraine will have bad image in U.S. related to corruption or situations like that, which can damage the image of Ukraine in the international arena.
Still, though, isn't it going to be a really tough tightrope for him to walk, for Zelensky to walk?
Yeah, that's true. Here, media are saying that Ukraine has got on between Democrats' rock and Republicans' hard place.
And, I mean, what are the different hypotheses on how this could impact Ukrainian-U.S. relations?
Well, first of all, if Ukraine starts an investigation into Hunter Biden, this means that we are playing against the potentially next president of the United States. And on the other hand, if we don't do this, if we refuse to do it, that we are playing against the current president. And also, given the military aid for Ukraine was frozen, and now we are in the situation where we don't know if we're going to get it or not, it's kind of like a bargaining chip in this situation.
So we see in this non-verbatim transcript that Trump really pushes Zelensky to look into the whole Biden affair. How do you think this is going to play out for Zelensky in the long run, to be kind of asked for these favors?
I think that there are reputational risks here, but so far we haven't seen any investigations being launched. That's why it's not like we're facing the situation where the president of the United States asks the Ukrainian president to do something and he does that favor. No investigations were made or launched. And in this transcript, we also see that Mr. Zelensky answered that all of the investigations will be transparent and public, so people will know what is going on.
That's Tatiana Kirilluk with BBC Monitoring in Kyiv. President Trump appeared irritated with reporters and Democrats today. Just a few days ago, Trump was very much in his preferred environment, a big stadium in Houston filled with about 55,000 people. Trump was there with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Houston is one of the largest Indian American communities in the U.S. The big splashy event was called Howdy Modi. As the world's Rupa Shenoy reports, media around the world portrayed the event as the political arrival of Indian Americans.
Once, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi was banned from the U.S. for alleged human rights abuses.
All together now, Howdy Modi!
But on Sunday, he strode on stage to the warm greetings of Texas lawmakers.
Good morning, Houston!
While Trump stood behind Modi, smiling, Modi praised the president as well-respected, popular, friendly, accessible, witty, and special. When it was Trump's turn, he returned the compliments and heaped praise on Indian Americans.
You are truly proud to be American, and we are proud to have you as Americans.
It looked like a political rally, and when Modi uttered the Hindi slogan that spread during the 2016 campaign, it completed the picture.
Ab ki baar, Trump sarkar.
Translation, this time a Trump government. But the event's chair, Jugal Malani, insists organizers never planned for Howdy Modi to be a political event. And they didn't know Trump was coming, he says, until the White House put out a press release.
Trump was, you know, kind of icing on the cake that really puts us in a different category altogether. You know, this has never happened before.
During the event, protesters outside the stadium held signs that objected to Modi's actions in Kashmir, his treatment of Muslims, and his Hindu nationalism. Among them was comedian Hasan Minhaj of the Netflix show Patriot Act.
Oh, this is like the Jay-Z and Beyonce of ethno-nationalism.
Yeah.
The next day, Minhaj told late-night host Seth Meyers organizers didn't allow him to attend because he had said critical things about Modi.
They're like, no, the comments you have made about Prime Minister Modi were not appreciated, and you have been blacklisted.
Wow.
And I was like, dude, you're treating me like Indian Jorge Ramos.
Jugal Malani, the organizer, says Minhaj is just trying to drum up publicity. Coverage of the event around the world hailed it as an unprecedented show of India's importance on the world stage and the Indian American community's strength. But Vinay Lal, a history and Asian American studies professor at UCLA, is skeptical.
the way that they are gloating about this, you know, no other prime minister or president of a foreign country has ever received, you know, this kind of treatment. You know, it shows the particular relationship that India now has with the United States. All of that is frankly hogwash, if you ask me.
Because, he points out, right after the event, Trump met with the leader of India's rival, Pakistan. And then there's the fact, Lal says, that the majority of Indian Americans vote Democrat.
They vote Democratic because they understand that they are a minority in the United States and that Democratic candidates are more likely to support minority rights. But when it comes to Indian politics, then they support Modi.
Sukhadad Thagi also made this point in a piece in the Texas Observer. She's an Indian journalist who lived in Houston.
I was really struck by this dichotomy of celebrating one of the most divisive world leaders of our times in one of the most pluralistic and multicultural cities in the U.S. and therefore the world, I would think.
She wrote that many Indians in America love diversity.
But, you know, they become different people when they hear of minorities back home in India. They refuse to see the oppression of these minorities in their home country.
So Indian Americans are diverse and they disagree with each other, especially now with Trump and Modi in office. Howdy Modi may have been portrayed as the coming out of the Indian American political community, but Thagi says there is no one Indian American political community. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
It's only September, but many stores are already prepping for, yeah, the holidays. And if you're shopping for a kid in your life, you might already be thinking of that perfect present. But if you walk into a toy store in France this holiday season, things may look a little different than you're used to.
You should not see a girl section and a boy section. So you will still see the pink and blue, but normally all the vendors should not ask you the first question, is it for a boy or is it for a girl?
The changes are set to come after an agreement among a group of industry executives and politicians. Eloise Pierre was one of them. She's founded a new toy company that's carved out a niche. Topla builds games for children to teach them about the harms of gender stereotypes. And Pierre thinks the industry in France is making the right move.
Starting from today, the toys industry in France will be less sexist, we will say.
Here's how. For one, France vowed to promote science and engineering toys to all kids, and they vowed to eliminate stereotypical descriptions on toys. So a mini broom and dustpan set that says, just like mom, that's not going to fly anymore. The initiative was spearheaded by the Secretary of State for Economy and Finance, Agnès Pannier-Runacher. But changing how toys are developed and marketed along gender lines is a big challenge. And a lot of people still think tanks and planes are for boys and dollhouses are for girls. That's the way it's always been. And what's wrong with that? Well, what's wrong, Pierre says, gender stereotypes learned at an early age can have long-term negative impacts.
So we need to move all together and to all educate each other because we are all learning now that this has really bad impact on our kids.
Gender differences are deeply entrenched in France. Women earn significantly less than men. They're underrepresented in science and engineering. Toy companies are trying to fix that. But this new set of agreements about how to market toys, it's not a law. So if folks in the toy industry don't follow through with their promises, they won't be punished. Still, Eloise Pierre is cautiously optimistic.
So, of course, not everything will change. And, of course, it will take lots of time. But some of the actors were really, and I think, deeply interested in trying to change.
Pierre says when it comes to eliminating gender stereotypes in toys, this holiday season or even the next, things won't be perfect, but they will improve. The group is set to meet again after the holidays to discuss their progress and set up new goals. For years now, Austria has been offering citizenship to victims of the Holocaust. But last week, the country's parliament voted to extend that right to the descendants of people who fled Austria to escape the Nazis, people like Ellen Garbuni. She's a social worker in Butler, Pennsylvania, whose mother fled Austria in 1938. News about her eligibility for citizenship left Ellen with mixed emotions.
I felt very rattled and excited because
it should have been my legacy to be Austrian all along.
We'll hear more from Ellen Garbuni over the next few minutes and from Amanda Hopkinson. She's a retired professor and writer in the UK. She told my colleague Carol Hills that she'll be applying for Austrian citizenship, partly because of what's going on in her country right now.
Boris Johnson, our present prime minister, with his constant talk of a no-deal Brexit, made me feel very displaced and very uncomfortable because I feel myself to be European. And I felt what I was experiencing was a very pale reflection of what my mother felt when she was hounded out of Austria into exile. And now I've discovered that the law that was passed in Austria last Thursday night on the 19th was passed on the back of support from the super right-wing party, the FPO, who calls people like me in Britain no longer Nazism victims, but Brexit victims. So I've actually got Boris Johnson to thank for putting this possibility on the map of being able to claim Austrian citizenship.
Now, you both have relatives who fled Austria. I'd like to know each of your stories. Ellen, let's start with you.
My mother was 14 years old when the Nazis marched into Vienna, and she knew at that time, as a teenager, life would never be the same for them. And within months, her family fled. And in 1939, they were in New York. My mother graduated from college in New York and married my father. And that's in, we were raised in Pittsburgh.
Amanda, you mentioned your mother. What's your connection to Austria?
My mother was a refugee who came over here when Austria was annexed by the Nazi regime in Germany. And she went back in March 38 to bring her mother out. Unfortunately, by then, her father had already died after an assault on their flat smashed the place up. He died of a heart attack. Mm. And my grandmother then, when she came over here in 1941, expecting Hitler to invade, and completely deracinated, you know, from her own home and culture and not speaking any English. On the third attempt, she committed suicide.
Mm. Oh, dear. Did you have any other family left in Austria, Amanda?
Every single one died in the camps. I found photographs after my mother's death of her cousins and everything written on the back, the names of the camps they died in. There was one very elderly aunt who managed to survive in Hungary, where the Nazis only came in 1944. But I'm afraid we couldn't see her because of the Iron Curtain. I never met her.
Ellen, why is it important for you to get Austrian citizenship?
Well, there's a couple reasons. One, if it hadn't been for the Holocaust, my mother would have never left Austria. So it's a tribute to my mother's family that I would do this for the continuity of that. Also, I am concerned about the state of our country and the rise of anti-Semitism here.
Well, I do agree with Ellen. It's some sort of a tribute to our mothers and what they had to go through, and some sort of restitution to be able to go back. But also, anti-Semitism is here in Britain. I know it's in Austria too. But I don't like the attitude of the present government towards Europe.
The government of Boris Johnson.
And in favor of a little Britain that hates foreigners. I'm the youngest of four sisters. They've all married foreigners and live on the continent of Europe. And my children, who are grown up, I have four children, they have partners who are also of mixed heritage, some European, some not. And all my children and grandchildren are absolutely delighted at the possibility that they might be able to stay European, which is what they feel they are, and have one foot in Europe if England is no longer a part of Europe and we exit with no deal from the EU.
When do you both plan on applying?
I don't think the infrastructure is set up yet, but as soon as it is, that day after.
It will be the 1st of September 2020, and
okay.
I'll be in the queue. Probably pretty near the front of the Austrian embassy applying for a visa and for residency and citizenship.
I hope they're prepared for an onslaught of applications that day.
Ellen Garbrunni in the U.S. and Amanda Hopkinson in the U.K. Both are descendants of people who fled the Nazis in Austria. They're now eligible to apply for Austrian citizenship starting next year. Thank you both for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Nice to hear you as well, Ellen. Okay.
Yes. Thank you, Amanda. Bye.
My colleague Carol Hill's in conversation there. Let's return to our top story, the memo, the declassified document the White House released relating a phone call between President Trump and Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. Here again is the world's Matthew Bell.
It's not actually a transcript. It's 3 pages of edited notes from the White House. But the content is shocking, according to Adam Schiff. He's the Democratic chairman of the House Intelligence Committee.
The notes of the call reflect a conversation far more damning than I or many others had imagined.
Schiff said it was hard to see how the administration would think that the document would somehow help President Trump's case.
Because what those notes reflect is a classic mafia-like shakedown of a foreign leader.
Schiff said the president has betrayed his oath of office by undermining America's national security, and that is potentially an impeachable offense. President Trump said that he put no pressure whatsoever on Ukraine's president. The two men met together and took questions from the press at the UN General Assembly in New York today. Trump portrayed himself as the real victim, and he said Joe Biden should be the target of any investigation.
Now, when Biden's son walks away with millions of dollars from Ukraine and he knows nothing and they're paying him millions of dollars, that's corruption. When Biden's son walks out of China with $1.5 billion in a fund, and the biggest funds in the world can't get money out of China, and he's there for one quick meeting and he flies in on Air Force Two, I think that's a horrible thing.
Trump went on to suggest that this is all political gamesmanship to prevent his reelection in 2020. And he had some parting words for House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
She's lost her way. She's been taken over by the radical left. She may be radical left herself, but she really has lost her way.
It's not clear what the president meant, but he said as far as he's concerned, Pelosi is no longer the Speaker of the House. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
And from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back here tomorrow. Thanks very much for being with us.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.